Shrinking the federal government's real estate holdings, it's the goal of seemingly every administration. But according to our next guest, and I quote, the budgetary rules that govern investment in these assets are a blunt instrument that does serious collateral damage. That's from Dorothy Robine, who wrote that in an article for the Brookings Institution. She's the former commissioner of the Public Building Service at GSA, and she joins us now. Now, Dorothy, great to have you back.
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you.
All right. So this is quite a powerful piece you've written here. And I just want to, before we get into the details, just review for us the scope of federal property as it stands right now.
Sure. Yeah, the federal government's real property portfolio, and that includes buildings and structures and land, is quite large. It's as big as the federal government's mission. So in terms of buildings, 365,000 buildings, 3.3 billion square feet of space in those buildings, which is six times more than all the commercial office space in Manhattan. Most of those buildings are located on military bases, about 300,000 of them. But we're also talking about federal courthouses, federal office buildings, land ports of entry, FBI field offices, Social Security call centers, Department of Energy labs, veterans hospitals, and many, many more civilian buildings. And those buildings are all part of an agency's ability to do its mission. So it's a big portfolio.
And in your paper, and this report, you cite the fact that the deteriorating condition of many of them is, you know, made the GAO's high risk list. Mm-hmm. But the reason is not incompetence or lack of budget, but something called Circular A11, one of the more venerable documents around the government. So how does that all work?
Well, and I think it does come back to lack of resources, but I think that this Circular A11 and particularly Appendix B is a little known contributor to the problem. This is something that was put in place 25 years ago after the Budget Enforcement Act of 1990, and it defined the difference between a capital lease and an operating lease. And that sounds very arcane, and it is very arcane, but it had huge implications for the way agencies like GSA and the Department of Defense, where I spent 3 years, manage their portfolio of buildings. So let me just back up a little bit and say that historically, both GSA and DOD had the ability to do what was called a lease purchase, basically like a mortgage that you would get to buy a home. So you would enter into a lease, and by the end of the lease or by the end of a period of time, you would own the building. And that was the way that the federal agencies acquired new facilities. In the 1980s, certain agencies, I would say, abused their leasing authority. There were tax advantages for leasing. There was a real shortage of resources. And so this was the time when the Department of Defense was using its leasing authority to acquire ships and aircraft, capital assets that clearly should not be acquired over time through a lease. And so Congress clamped down, and in turn, the Office of Management and Budget, Congressional Budget Office, CBO, put out these new rules on leasing. And what they did immediately was to put a halt to this practice of lease purchases, whereby agencies like GSA and DOD could, over time, through their annual mortgage payments, if you will, acquire the ownership of a building. Under these A11 rules, any lease that results in the federal government owning a building is treated as a capital lease, and that means that the agency has to put all of the money up front in the first year. It would be equivalent to you having to put all the cash up front to buy a house. Very few people could buy a house if that were the requirement, and the same is true for federal agencies.
So what has been the consequence of that system?
And let me just say one other. So over time, also, those rules have been interpreted to preclude any form of public-private partnership, so any use of private financing to, say, renovate, to do a major renovation of a federal building. And there are good, you know, there were good reasons for that. And the fundamental one is cost, that it does cost a federal agency. All else equal, it costs more to use private dollars to borrow money than it does to have the federal government finance something directly, because the Treasury can borrow at the lowest rate of anybody. That's the fundamental argument here. But that assumes that agencies have the ability to come up with all of the money up front to either acquire a new building or to undertake a major renovation. And that has not been the case over the course of 23 years. That has clearly not been the case. So what has happened? Classic case of the law of unintended consequences. Two things that I would flag. One, and particularly for GSA, they have gone more and more to short-term leases, meaning 10-year leases, to meet long-term agency needs. So just exactly what the rules were trying to get away from, GSA has had to fall back on the use of short-term leases. GSA leases more property than it owns. Right now, basically all of the incremental growth in the federal real estate inventory over the last 25 years has been met through the use of leased space. And my favorite example, the new Department of Transportation headquarters, beautiful building designed by Michael Graves down on the Anacostia River.
I've walked by it many times on the way to the baseball games.
And you probably didn't realize that is a leased building. You probably thought that was the federal government's Department of Transportation and that they owned it. And that's not the case. It's a GSA building. It's a leased building. GSA leases it for $45 million a year. It's a 15-year lease. If it had been a longer lease, it would have been a capital lease under these scoring rules, and that would have precluded entering into that lease. So it's a 15-year lease. At the end of 15 years, having spent around close to $700 million, GSA will have to extend the lease or recompete the requirement. It will have no equity in the building.
So it's $700 million over that lease period. That's probably about what it would have cost to build it.
Well, it's more than. It's almost twice what it cost to build the building, yeah. And there was an opportunity to negotiate a lease that would have resulted in federal ownership of that building at the end of, say, 25 years, or that would have given the federal government a discounted price at the end of some term. Both of those are standard practices in commercial industry. Neither of those were permissible under these budget rules. So you have a set of budget rules that are designed for a world in which there is plenty of resources for the federal government to do everything on a cash basis, but that isn't the world that we live in. And so we are precluding options that are actually less expensive than the alternatives. In addition to relying heavily on leasing, agencies have postponed major capital investment. And here is where shrinking the footprint comes in. There's enormous desire on the part of federal agencies to reduce their real estate footprint so that they can put their precious resources into mission activities, into personnel and directly mission-related activities. Often that requires getting out of expensive lease space, moving walls so that you can move more people into a building. There is a tremendous opportunity to do this, but it takes upfront capital. It takes capital to do that, and that has not been available.
We're speaking with Dorothy Robine. She's former commissioner of the Public Building Service at GSA and has some extensive experience with military property, too. So GSA knows this. Members of Congress know this, and federal managers who have to live with it know it. Why hasn't anything changed, and what would you change now to try to get out from under all this leasing?
I think members of Congress do not understand it. First of all, it would not require statutory change, because these rules that I'm referring to, it's a circular. It is a policy document issued by OMB and by CBO. And the House and Senate Budget Committees are also part of that process. But it is an OMB document, and it can be changed short of legislation. There have been carve-outs. The most famous carve-out, and it's a huge success story, is the military family housing, which over the course of the last 20 years has been privatized, meaning that developers have come in and taken what was really 200,000 units of family housing that were in terrible shape.
Dilapidated.
Yeah, this was a quality of life issue. When I dealt with it in the mid-90s working in the Clinton White House, it was making it harder for the military to recruit and retain people. DOD got special dispensation to team up, partner with developers, and developers came in and built new or renovated those. We have 200,000 units of very, very nice housing built and maintained to market standards. It was done with a 50-year ground lease, typically, of the property. At the end of that 50 years, all of the improvements transfer. The property goes back to DOD ownership. It's a tried and true method of getting major renovation done. There's many opportunities to do that kind of thing with GSA buildings, which have a stream of revenue in the form of agency rents, with other types of structures on military bases, with VA hospitals and clinics. There's an enormous need here, and we're getting hung up on a set of very, very well-meaning rules, but that have had unintended consequences.
Can I just ask you a detail question?
Sure.
The Park Lawn structure that was probably one of the worst buildings in the hemisphere for HHS has just been renovated, and the government, you know, took it down to the bones and rebuilt it. Do you know anything about that particular structure? Who owns it, or is that a lease out deal?
You know, I better not say anything, because that happened before I
okay.
got to GSA. Let me not comment on that.
Just curious,
because
I drive by it, and one of my neighbors just moved into the new space there. It says it's gorgeous, so I just wondered how they do that. So again, so getting back to Circular A11,
yeah.
And the unintended consequences are even greater costs than if the government could build and own, and also on the other end, worse conditions and deterioration.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
All right. So what should Circular A11 say then to maybe start to remedy some
of
this?
Well, I have thoughts. Other people have thoughts. What I'm trying to do is stimulate a debate. This subject is so technical and so arcane that very, very few people understand it outside of the federal real estate circle. I have met only three members of Congress who understand it. One is a tax lawyer. Another came out of the real estate industry. This is not a well-understood problem. So what I'm trying to do is stimulate a debate. I think I want to get policymakers and the scorekeepers, meaning Congressional Budget Office, OMB, the budget committees, to sit down and talk about how to improve this. I have an idea, but I think there's many ways that you can do it. This is a policy that has outlived its usefulness in its current form. I would not throw it out altogether. I think that you need something that keeps agencies from doing projects that private borrowing rates that are excessive. So I think there need to be controls in place, but I think the ones that we have are counterproductive.
All right, and a personal question.
Yeah.
Looking at your bio at the end of this article, it lists everywhere you have been. What is your perch today?
Well, I am perched in my home on Capitol Hill, writing away.
So Dorothy Robine, private citizen.
Exactly. Yes. No. I'm going to focus on this issue and how improving energy efficiency in federal buildings. And I have a lot of pent up
things you want to say, and now you can say them.
Things I want to say, and things that I can now speak my mind on.
Yeah. All right. Dorothy Robine is the former commissioner of the Public Building Service at GSA. As always, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to talk to you, Tom.